Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Simon Morris, welcome to Just Not Good Enough, mental health podcast, radio show, whatever you want to call it. We've been through a bit about your mental health and how you deal with it and all that sort of stuff. But how then, given all of that, have you been so successful in your career? You know, you've got Amazon behind you, for one thing. You've got Love Film. You've got Novel. You've got so many entrepreneurial roles, but also so many corporate roles. And I'm just thinking, in my experience, an entrepreneur is an entrepreneur and can't take corporate stuff. But you seem to have done both. What is it about you that you think that made that happen?
I think my life in terms of work, I think the bit that nearly killed me is also the bit that speaks to that in me, in my character, in my makeup. So the drive, I often think about life and tools in terms of a double-edged sword. You know, there's an edge to the sword that can cut through any obstacle, and there's the edge to that sword that can cut and kill you. But they're very closely linked. You know, there's a yin and a yang and a inseparable combination of those two things. So for me, I know when I look back on my life, I know from an early age, I had a drive in me, and I had a ambition. Not so much an ambition. I never saw myself as an ambitious in a job, but I knew I was going somewhere.
You wanted to do something.
I was going somewhere, and I was doing something, and I wanted to achieve, and I wanted to. It wasn't necessarily money focused, but I was going somewhere, and I think that was in me. That is also characterized by more. You know, I do everything more. You know, they often talk about addiction as a disease of more, but I work hard. Relentless. Non-stopping. You know, when I did boxing in my life, you know, you'd have to knock me out to stop me. But I'll generally work as harder than the average bear, longer than the average bear, and with an engine in me that is just driving me forward. And I think that was what got me in trouble. You know, I never had a sense of balance. I never had a sense of stopping.
Everything to excess.
Everything, a lot of things to excess. Mm-hmm. But it was also channeled in the right direction, part of whatever success I've had along the way in terms of work. And that has, it's interesting, you talked about corporate. I've worked in, been part of startups, helped startups, been in smaller companies, fast growth companies, and then all the way through to
possibly the biggest company in the planet.
$1 trillion market cap company. Yeah. Which, by the way, you know, my 10 years at Amazon were absolutely fantastic. And
I've wondered what you're going to say then.
No, fantastic. And I was in environment with people and leaders, business leaders there that encouraged, were accepting of my skill set and my potential limitations. Were very.
Why do you say it like that?
Well, I did feel when I was in my 10 years at Amazon that I didn't have to try and compensate or cover up or hide the things that I wasn't good at. They were very clear. I had a boss, somebody called Neil Lindsay, the big boss, the founder, who were really encouraging and clear about, right, this is what we think you're good at. This is what an area that you can add value and here's how we can remove things from your corporate life, from your work that might limit that. You know, I'm terrible at maths. People always ask me that. And, you know, I failed my maths O-level 4 times.
It's an achievement.
it's quite a record, you know. Yeah. I was like the big kid with, you know, starting to grow a beard, sitting in the gym doing my O levels when children, you know, kids 4 years younger were doing their O level maths early, and that was always a source of shame for me.
Of course, yeah.
But you know, I can see things in business. There's a great book in business called Legacy, what we can learn from the All Blacks, what we can learn about life in business from the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, manners, principle, humility, the way to behave. But they also talk about commitment. You know, they talk about you don't necessarily have to have the start. You have the hardest working and you have the team orientated, but you also have people that have the gift of pre-visualization. I know that I can see things, and I don't mean in the sense of that film. I see dead people. What I mean is I can.
But that's,
I can
that's
see
creativity
a problem.
In you.
Yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
Creativity. I can see a problem. I can see a vision, and I can, and then I've got an engine that can work relentlessly towards that. And that's my DNA. That's my stock in trade, and I think I do think, you know, in recovery, in the years that I've had in recovery, I spent a lot of time in the prison system. 16 years in places like Wormwood Scrubs and Brixton, and that's, you know, I see people there that are addicts
desperate,
you know, that were dealt a different set of cards in life, and you know, I find that very humbling. And
just come back to Amazon. Sorry, Amazon. Yeah. Did they know about your addiction?
Yeah, I had been honest about that from Love Film, which you know, my rock bottom was 2001. Took a while to get myself back to get some sort of semblance of life back together. Rebuild, you know, myself as a husband and a father and my family. And then I got involved with Love Film. So I had been very honest about it from
there. How did they react? How did Amazon react, for example?
Look, I find, whether it was me and Amazon or me and you know, my partners and co-founders in businesses that I've been involved in, I've got to a point where I don't worry about that. You know, the truth is the truth. And I'm going to give it my best shot. But part of my makeup is that I've had a fatal illness all my life that I do something about on a regular basis. And I grew up in a world where, I think you did too, showing perceived weakness is not a good thing.
No,
you know,
not.
When I'm in the prison system, you're in a really acute environment where showing a weakness is not a good thing. And yet, the path to recovery is accepting what that weakness is, right? And being able to be honest about it. Now, you don't necessarily have to go and shout it from the rooftops, right? And you have to respect people's anonymity because it sometimes might not be the right thing. I have found in my life that most of the time, it's totally okay for people to know that. And I also got to a point where I realized that if someone wants to use that weakness against you, then that's on them. That's on them. That's nothing to do with you. And the truth
is, it's hard to think that though and believe it.
It takes a while, you know, and it takes practice. And all of this, I told you, is a constant thing. There's not a steady state nirvana that you arrive at where you go, right, I'm fixed now. There's a constant set of things that you have to do to maintain that. You know,
how do we imagine yourself as a young buck, you know, just starting out in your career, and you're aware of this particular issue that you have, a state of condition that you have, and how can we make it easier then for people who are?
I don't think I was aware of it.
I wasn't, but just imagine somebody who might be aware of it, and they're ambitious and they want to get on the career ladder.
Yeah,
but how do they talk about it at work and say, I've got this issue that I'm dealing with, blah blah blah, or do they just hide it, suffer in silence, but avoid the stigma of people knowing.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me that there's no win-win out of that at all, really.
Look, I just to be clear, I definitely did not feel stigmatized in any of the work environments that I'd been in, whether it was Love Film, whether it was, you know, the thing that I'm involved in at the moment, Jack. It's all about mental health, peer-to-peer, helping mental health. I most certainly did not feel that at Amazon. I felt they were...
About earlier in your career, like way earlier.
I think times were different then.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started work life in advertising, play hard, work hard, play hard. And then I went to Virgin and launched Sega, was part of the small team that launched Sega here. Then I went to BSkyB, which was a very disruptive challenger, exciting business at the time.
Oh, that's interesting. You say exciting when you use those words before.
Well, I'm drawn to that. You know, I'm drawn to disruption and chaos and you know, sticking two fingers up to authority. I still have big issues with authority and being told what to do, which is weird, isn't it, in a workplace, right?
Well, no, it's not, because that's part of my character, isn't it?
Yeah, it's part of my character.
But that's if people then realise that.
Yeah.
And embrace it and use it,
yeah.
Then actually the creativity and the ideas that come out of it can be transformative for an organisation.
But I think it was, you know, you grow up and fear is a big part of it. You know, fear of, I saw Mel Gibson talk about the single biggest fear most people have is humiliation, public humiliation. Once you can get beyond that, you know, and I definitely grew up spinning plates, worried about what people think. And it's very freeing when you can live a life where you don't worry about that.
Yeah, but that's an age thing, isn't
it's an age thing. It's an experience thing. And it's also, in my case, having a near-death experience because of your addictive behaviours.
Yeah.
And so most of the time now, I don't worry about that. And I've also found, look, the good news is, I think... society, business, government, schools are way more attuned to mental health and conversations around it than ever before. You know, there's a lot of Danny Evans, the founder of Jack, talks about his frustration that we haven't, in fact, gone far enough. You know, this let's talk about mental health. His view is, yeah, let's talk about mental health. Let's be honest about mental health, but let's have a plan to help people. Let's have practical tools to help people beyond that. You know, 20, 30 years ago, you definitely didn't. You talked about, I looked at my grandfather, who I love, Reg, who I love more than life itself. He was my granddad. He was my hero. He went on D-Day. You know, 25 years old, left his family at home, left his young kid at home, went over on those beaches and then worked his way up through, came back, clearly had PTSD, was told just to get on with it and, you know, became
thank
a postman.
God we've moved, thank God we've moved beyond thank, that.
I hope.
But it's still there, though.
It's still there. It's understood. It's misunderstood in many places. It's feared
it's
in many
places.
It's
abused, actually, as well.
It's probably abused. There's also some people that, you know, don't do it a disservice by, you know, pretending.
Bunking off
on it and saying they've got depression. So, but generally, the shift has been towards in the right direction. Okay, it's got further to go, but it's been in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I definitely would say to anyone listening to this, you know, if you've got those... if you've got those conditions or those fears or those self-doubts, you know, it's not something you can solve on your own. You know, you cannot do it on your own.
But getting over that, opening up for the first time is really hard.
That's the cliff, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if you think in terms of a visual metaphor, you've got a cliff to climb. And then it's a steady slope uphill from there, or it's rolling hills thereafter.
The ironic thing about that, of course, is that a cliff, you can fall off the bloody thing as well.
You can fall backwards
Can fall backwards and help yourself, but if you fall off...
I think we're overworking our metaphors
well,
now.
Well, possibly, but I was quite enjoying it. Honestly, I mean, this has been, we have run out of time. I can't believe it, actually. But have we run out of time? Okay, all right. Okay, all right.
Are we done?
No, we're not.
Oh, okay.
No, sorry. Can't get out of it that easily.
That's all right.
Yasmin's been asking about, Yasmin's our producer,
yeah.
been asking about some of your iconic adverts.
Yeah.
So where did they come from? How do you do that? How do you create that?
I love the space of like-minded or complementary-minded creative people working together to come up with ideas and creative solutions to big challenges, business problems. I just love it. I love that. I love being in that space, you know, at Novel. I'm chairman of a company called Novel, which is, I think it's the leading independent podcast company. I've realized that
what, more than FUBAR.
I realize that I'm the old fart in the room now, and yet I still love being around the creative process. So, whether it's advertising, film, TV, product, technical innovation, apps, you know, some sort of digital service, the principles are very similar. I've learned over the years that there are certain mental models that you can apply to make it easier. I'm always interested in a different way into, quite often problems have been solved before. Very often the creativity is finding a different way into expressing that. Mm. So on things like in TV, I was involved at Ginger TV when we had, for those of you that, listeners that are old enough, we had TFI Friday, Don't Forget Your Toothbrush.
Yep, I remember
you
that.
Know, and Chris was a genius. Will McDonald was great. You know, there were producers around. And it was a very fertile, expressive environment where you're not afraid to try stuff, not afraid to push boundaries, you know. I wished I could sing a note and, you know, have lived a more rock and roll life in terms of musical outlet.
Wouldn't have done your addiction.
I'd definitely be dead by now. I've thought about that as well. But how do those, you know, things that I look back on in my career that I'm really proud of, there was a commercial that we did at Amazon for in Christmas of 2015, I think it was. If you Google it, it's Priest and Imam Amazon commercial. And it's,
I remember that. It's with the kneelers.
With the knee pads, yeah.
Well, that made it, I mean, the fact that I can remember it, and it's not been on telly for God knows how long.
8 years, yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely...
It was
fantastic.
It was, you know, came from a team of people looking, you know, we said to ourselves, look, how can we tell a story that shows empathy, shows sympathy, and leans into... putting something on what everyone's thinking at the moment. So we set out to tell that story, and then we arrived at that, went through 20, 30 different scripts, different problems, different, and then I think it was a last minute, you know, I think I said, why don't we, should we look at religion? And everyone went, oh, you know, skating on thin ice.
But
that's why.
That's the juxtaposition of those two.
That's why it was successful.
Exactly.
And it was, you know, my boss at the time, Neil Lindsay, was a big supporter. We took it to, you know, Jeff, the big boss at Amazon, who was really supportive. There was a lot of debate amongst senior leadership about whether it was too edgy. There were some clear inputs that we set, that we decided as a group, that we were going to do. It had to be authentic. It had to be a real imam. It had to be a real priest. We had to have wardrobe right. We had to shoot it in the East London Mosque. We had to get permission to do that. We had to get permission from, I think I went to Westminster, to the Church of England. I went to an interfaith group in Washington. I went to a chief rabbi in New York.
We went
and sense checked it.
Just for an advert.
Yeah, and
That's a commitment to the cause, isn't it?
Yeah, and Jeff was really clear about have a backup plan. And if this thing, this creative idea is meant to happen, it will happen without you forcing it to happen. But if at any point we get resistance where people say, listen, that's not right, be prepared to drop it, which was an incredibly enlightened view. And so, and we did. And at one point we even got an email. I wish I could find it. We got an email from the Vatican saying that the message contained in that ad was something that the Pope thought was, I'm mangling
oh,
it.
Oh, you've got to find that.
I know. I need the guys at Joint to find that, dig that out. But it was so well received from all sides.
It was so warm.
And it was organically, you know, it had hundreds of millions of organic social shares as a result of it, because the message was good. And it was brave and it was innovative. I think other ideas, you know, lessons that I've learned in recovery, I apply to the creative and my business environment. So I think I talked to you before about a good saying that you hear in 12-step recovery is look for the similarities, not the differences.
Yeah.
I try and do that in my creative work. So what's a good example of that? Or act with humility, or be prepared to be self-critical. There was a Super Bowl ad that we did for Amazon for Alexa where it's all about Alexa's lost her voice, which was, you know, if you stop to think about it, it was a company entertaining the concept that the product that they have doesn't
work.
Right? But don't worry, because we've got, you know, the story is we've got replacements lined up for Alexa because she's got a cough. And of course, those replacements are people like Cardi B and Gordon Ramsay and Anthony Hopkins, and they're terrible. Yeah. They're either frightening or terrible or sweary or whatever it is. But what was interesting there is that we behaved as human beings rather than a business. And I do think that people, customers, like that. Uh-huh. They like you to be open and honest and humble and empathetic.
But your customer is number one.
And laugh at yourself. Yeah. You know, the ability to laugh at yourself. I think we Brits are brilliant at that.
Yeah, we are.
We're particularly good at taking the piss out of ourselves and people we love. That sometimes doesn't travel as much. But in that instance, I think it was, My boss Neil always used to say, "Does this make you feel uncomfortable? Good, you know. If it's not making you feel uncomfortable, it's too safe. If it's, you know, creative. I'm sure you've heard that expression. Creative. You know, a donkey is a horse designed by a committee. You know, if you put too many people, there'll be a tendency to neuter something or take away the ambition or play safe." And the best cut through, innovative, creative stuff does make you feel slightly.
Of course, it does.
I can feel it now, even just talking about it. You know, after I don't know how many decades I've been working, I still love that.
So I get that from the theatre. Right? Yeah, so I go to the theatre a lot.
Yeah.
And I always say that the theatre's not good or bad, because it just should make you feel different.
Yeah.
In some way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, you get some appalling stuff sometimes, but I still feel different because I'm angry about it, or I think, oh, for God's sake, that's bloody rubbish. You know?
It's made you feel something.
It's made me feel something, and that's why I love it. And I'm not a creative person at all, because I'm an accountant, for Christ's sake. But not that those two necessarily go hand in hand.
We're all read John Hegarty's book on creativity, and you know, it's very reassuring that there's creativity in all of us. You don't have to be a stereotypical.
No, you don't have to be an artist or anything.
Swivel-eyed loon, as someone might call me.
Swivel-eyed loon, love it.
But I, you know, I'm like that with film. I'm like that with film, TV, music.
Yeah, I guess I'm the same. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It has to make you feel differently. So just one question was hanging in my mind: is are you more or less creative when you're feeling down?
I'm not sure I'd characterize it as more or less. I can certainly, you know, I spoke to, I'd be breaking an anonymity. I spoke to a very well-known famous musician from a very well-known band who once told me that in his darkest days of struggling, he wrote his best music, and he never found that. He never found that patch, purple patch again.
No, it's about that, because a lot of music's about angst, yeah, isn't
and,
it?
I think, you know, I can wake up in the middle of the night. I often wake up in the middle of the night and text myself ideas or write stuff down. You can find ideas and creativity in any emotion, I think. So I'm not sure I'd be able to answer it. Am I more or less?
Different.
Here's the good news. When you're down, you know, you can channel that into something creative.
So I think we're going to have to sort of pause, I think, for now, because we've been going for Christ knows how long. Absolutely fascinating. But I think it's almost like a celebration of mental health in some ways, because if you can learn to channel it, actually,
it's a superpower.
It can be. There's a book, I can't remember who wrote it, called Depression, the Curse of the Strong.
Yeah, look, if anyone out there is listening to this, you know, and there's a characteristic, and there's a what you think of as a you know, massive problem in your makeup. Yeah, I got a diagnosis for ADHD as recently as 3-4 years ago. You know, Kel Surprise, I was the last person to know, apparently, according to a lot of my friends. I think, you know, I'm innumerate, I'm colorblind, I'm, you know, afflicted by addiction, depression, character disorders, you know, but I've done all right.
Yeah, it shows you can.
So anyone out there, you know, these things are, if you can channel them, they're a superpower.
They're a part of you.
You know, I'll give you another metaphor. You know, a nuclear power station. I went on a visit at Sizewell Power Station the other day, and I'm fascinated by it. You know, nuclear fission is really destructive. It's in an open environment. But, you know, rods in a contained environment, channeled, can power, you know, enough power to fuel 10% of UK homes.
Yeah.
So if you've got a perceived weakness or a shortcoming or a fault, and it's channeled in the right way, it can become a superpower and the key to unlocking, you know, a much better life.
Yeah. Managing and channeling is probably the message.
In any form of recovery of any condition, the keystone to that is connectivity, you know, the understanding that the acceptance that you can't do it on your own, and that, I mean, it's as old as the hills, a problem shared is a problem halved, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, but it is
true. I'm a man.
Yeah.
You're a man.
Yeah, that's right.
It's so hard,
it's hard to
share it. And I also think the language, we don't have the language to do it.
Yeah.
You know, or we're getting better at it, but certainly in 2012, I had no idea how to describe what was going on.
Yeah, but also getting attuned to, sometimes people don't say, you know, there's a really good definition of fine, I'm fine, which I've always loved. I learned in a treatment centre, which stands up for, we can't swear on here, can we?
But yes, you can say whatever you like. You can swear at anything.
I'm fine is I'm fucked up, insecure, neurotic and emotional, you know. And in my experience of, in my 22 years or 8,000 days of plus days of recovery from alcoholism, I've noticed that no one ever walks up to me and says, hey, it's interesting that you know, shared that, I've got a problem. They never say that. And you learn to spot people, you learn to spot what they're communicating to you beyond their words.
How do you do that, though?
You develop a sixth sense. You know that the very fact that they're talking to you, the very fact that they want to talk to you one-to-one, is an indication that here's someone who needs some help.
Yeah.
And then you just talk to them about it, and you share your experience.
I've always found that first opening of a conversation really, really difficult. Yeah. I find it really easy now, because I almost, you know, it's first time I meet people, I'll within about 5 minutes, I'll have told them I live with depression, yeah. you know, so yeah. don't worry if you think you've upset me, because you haven't. It's just the way I react.
And me too. And then I usually share that. I usually share that with people, which...
Does that get a different reaction from them? Do they treat you differently, do you think?
I don't know. I think I got to a point in my journey where I was brought up in a world where you don't show a weakness, ever.
I'm sorry for laughing, but yeah. this is just so, it resonates. So my dad, he came from the war, you know, and we were talking about FUBAR and what it means a little earlier. He came from the war and he said nothing about his mental health, what
Same
he's experienced, what he's seen. And I just remember years and years ago, when I was probably about seven, something like that, he went to hospital for 6 months. And my mum said it's his arthritic hip, because we now believe
but
that.
It was
it's a psychiatric hospital because he was in some severe trouble.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, is it hereditary? I don't know. There must be something in it, perhaps.
I think it's my experience that I'm not a doctor, I'm not medically trained, but, you know, I've got, if I look at my app here, which records my number of days in recovery from alcoholism, I have 8,196 days, or 22 years, 5 months and 9 days without a drink. And
wow.
I find
congratulations.
That,
well done.
Mate. But as I once heard Anthony Hopkins say, you know, don't give me credit for saving my own life, you know. It's
I saw Ruby Wax once on stage at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, and she was talking about depression because she'd got this manual out or something. And she said, she gets it really badly, I think.
Yeah.
And she said, it's always waiting in the wings.
It's always there. Yeah,
it's always there.
Churchill talked about it, didn't he? The black dog in
the corner. Yeah, because he had a black dog. Yeah.
And it's ever present. It's an ever present factor in your life. But it's like anything. If you learn to live with it, then if understanding it, accepting it, learning to live with it, developing tools to handle it, you're never fixed.
No,
you're never free from fear. You're
never cured.
Fixed. You're never cured. But you know, they talk about a daily reprieve from a fatal illness, and I always remind myself of that on a daily basis. But going back to your point about the medical, it's my experience from the number of meetings, the thousands of meetings I've been to, the thousands, tens of thousands of people I've heard share. And my own family and people that I've become closer to in recovery. It's my experience that addiction runs in families, for sure.
Do you think so? Actually, my uncle was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
My mother was abstemious.
Without a doubt. Well, I've got people in my family that, you know, it's like a curse that runs through generations. But there is no logic to it. They talk about addiction as cunning, powerful, and baffling.
Yeah.
Right? You never... There isn't a set path. There aren't patterns to it that you can... There's some commonalities. But, you know, what may keep you sober one day and the next day and the next day will suddenly not work. And that's the biggest learning of... The single biggest learning and the thing that I try and pass on, that normal tools in life don't work when it comes to mental health and addiction, right? Or particularly with addiction. So if you are conscious of, you know, you feel you're in that panic stage where you know you're drinking too much, you try and do something about it, and you normally resort to the tools that you grew up with. You learn how to problem solve. You have experience, right? Don't touch that. It's hot. You know, that's going to burn you. Don't put a jumper on when it's cold. You have tools that you've learned from the earliest possible age to equip you to solve problems. If your existing tools and experience don't work, then you might resort to hypothesis. So, right, what, trial and error? Why don't I try this, see if that works? All of that doesn't work when it comes to addiction. So the thing that will keep you clean and sober one day won't work the next day. or it might work for a period of time.
So how do you deal with that then? What do you do? Because I've found this cocktail, if you like, yeah, of things that I do to just help me.
Yeah.
And it changes all the time because I get fed up of it or something. But I'm just always looking for the right mix of things that I can do to help me with my mental health.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well,
though, when you're addiction?
I do 12-step. I do, 12-step.
What's that? Sorry, I'm not familiar with
12-step is things like AA or NA or CA.
Okay.
There are, look, in London alone, I think there, I recently looked, there's over 1,000 meetings a week. So there's a resource that's freely available for people who want it, and a tried and trusted path of 12-step recovery that's been around for coming up to 100 years, that is a mainstay of my maintenance. And then I just have other tools, meditation, prayer, the commitment to being ruthlessly self-honest and critical.
Mm.
Don't, we were talking earlier on about someone asks you how you're doing and you say, fine. I'd never do that. I try and assess myself on a daily basis, truthfully, see where I am.
Doesn't it, if you do that, to be truthful, that's the opportunity for the beating yourself up again and not showing yourself enough compassion, because you're always looking for the truth. But if you are a depressive, you look for the negatives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a brutal characteristic of any mental illness.
Yeah.
I've learned over time, and in recovery, that I have always veered between two states in life, what I call more than or less than, usually less than. Usually I'm not good enough, usually catastrophizing, usually thinking those people think this about me, and developing multiple chips on my shoulder. But your main position is less worthy. Then you overcompensate, and I used to find if I had a drink, I'd definitely overcompensate and become a bit of a more than, where I'm looking down on people. And neither of those states, I'd become.
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
That's where the anger comes out. That's where the fuck you comes out.
But doesn't the personality come out at the same time? Because you see, that's what I do. I always think I'm less than.
Yeah.
But then when I'm in a social situation, maybe I've had a drink or two.
Yeah, the front.
I become not the entertainer because I'm not good enough for that.
Yeah.
But just not good enough, obviously, again. But my personality comes out and I hide behind my personality because I'm a people pleaser.
I think everyone does that to a certain extent. But the two states, both of those states are unhealthy and they're not natural. You're not unworthy, and neither are you better than. So what you're striving to achieve is a space in the middle, which is a place of acceptance and serenity. And I thought that was very woo-woo and, hippie and space age when I came in, but I've come to understand it over time.
I've just understood what you meant.
Totally all right.
Yeah.
You're not trying to find a place where you're happy, happy, happy all the time. What you're trying to find is an operating space to go about your life, your work, your responsibilities, where you are completely all right.
Yeah.
Accepting of what life's thrown at you, balanced in your understanding and perception of problems, balanced and understanding in your understanding of your good fortune at the moment, not overblowing your abilities and certainly not undervaluing your abilities. You're totally all right. They call it serenity.
Yeah.
And that's the golden state that you're aiming for.
How often do you get that?
I have periods now where I have, I have to have a check-in with myself, and I think, what's going on with me? And then I realise, I've had a sustained period of absolutely all right. So I can go for days, weeks where I'm all right, and then out of the blue I can be hit with a black cloud of despondent depression, or I can be hit by a period of manicness, or I can be hit by fear. Fear, I think I've got a reasonable relationship with. You and I would talk about special forces before we started, yeah. and you know, realizing that you're never going to live a life free of fear is a big step. And then understanding when fear shows up in your life that you can channel it.
You have to embrace it, don't you?
You embrace it, you lean into it, and you can use it to channel you. You can use it to get out of bed. You can use it to unparalyze. Is that a word? You know, yeah. To fight the paralysis that you get with a depression.
Because a getting out of bed is, I get that massive. Occasionally. You know, you just, and I never, ever understood it. And yeah. It's usually alcohol related, actually, yeah. Funnily yeah. enough. And I may have had a few too many. And then yeah. The next morning, I literally cannot get out of bed.
That's right.
And when my...
It's a combination of physical hangover.
Yeah.
You know, massively accelerated depression.
Yeah.
You know, the there's something going on with you physiologically just yes. as a result of the hangover from the alcohol the night before. But everything, it's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
And that is crippling. And so
it is. And my second son was born, and the morning we were going to collect him from hospital, I couldn't get out of bed. And my mother-in-law had to drive in London. She'd just lost her husband, right? Yeah. This is bloody terrible, this. Yeah. But she'd just lost her husband a month earlier,
yeah.
My wife's father. And she had to drive through London, and she hates driving, and she certainly hates driving in London. And I let her do that. Because yeah. I couldn't get out of bed.
What an angel she was.
She absolutely. But I feel so awful about that. But I literally couldn't do anything else.
Well, listen, we could do a whole... We could talk for hours about shame.
Yeah.
You know, shame is an obvious and ever-present part of any addiction, mental health challenge. You know, it's part of... Sometimes when I stop to think about that, and when I have people that I'm trying to help and they talk about shame, you know, shame can also be a bit healthy. You know, if you lean into it, if you see when shame turns up, if you try and figure out, okay, so why am I feeling shame? And you question it, you know, is it true? Have you got something to be ashamed about? Or not. And if you have got something to be ashamed about, well, learn from it and don't do it again.
Yeah.
And if you haven't, it goes back to what I was talking about, you know, feeling less than, low self-esteem,
beating yourself up, low compassion for yourself,
characterized by shame. That's all part of that, you know, less than state.
Yeah.
And it comes part and parcel with it. And so, but it's... I also accept it. I also accept that I'm not going to get rid of shame. And I also have learned to question it. You know, if I've done things in my life that I am shameful of and still, but I just try to make sure that won't happen again.
Does it convert to guilt or vice versa?
It's guilt. Guilt, you know, all of these, we could build a nice little word cloud, couldn't we?
Yeah.
Words to describe it. That state. Yeah.
But I find guilt and shame, I mean, they're obviously very different.
Yeah.
But I find that if I'm doing something and I suddenly feel guilty because I think I've upset that person yeah. or done something wrong,
yeah.
I will feel really guilty. I'll then convert that to shame and yeah. think, shit, I'm a bad person. No other adjectives will do there. That's yeah. it. I am an absolute bad person.
You're in that spiral.
Yeah.
But if you're stuck in self... in that place, it's dangerous. So that's where, you know, I have tools. I've got I'm looking down at my phone, I've got a WhatsApp group of fellas, the chaps, that are, some of whom are in recovery, some of whom are just good spiritual warriors. I've got people wrapped around me that I can talk to and tell anything at any time, middle of the night, and I know they'll be there for them, as they know I'll be there for them. So that's a good one. And also,
that is a good one.
Yeah. Understanding, reminding yourself that feelings aren't facts. So, guilt and shame are feelings. They're not tangible. And you know, I haven't got any tattoos, but a good candidate for a tattoo on my forearm or somewhere I could remind myself when I see it every day. Feelings are not facts, and I tend to. Most of the time be driven by feelings that are negative and destructive and false. And then again, feelings that are perhaps over elated and over confident. And so, you know, see, trying to find this balance.
I don't get that last bit.
Let me be clear. My steady state is less than. And so I'm having to have a word with myself that, you know, yeah, you are good enough. Yeah, you are. Or that isn't true. That isn't people's perception of you, or that isn't the case.
Do you believe yourself?
I look, after nearly 23 years, yeah, I more often than not I do. And, you know, it's not perfect. You're never completely cured. You're managing something.
Yeah.
And that sounds depressing. If someone's listening to this and thinking, I need to change and I need to save my life, but here's someone who's 23 years down the line and they're still talking about a daily experience of that. It's manageable.
But it's inspiring, isn't it? Your story is inspiring because you are managing. You've recognised it.
Yeah.
You've found what works for you.
Yeah.
And you're managing it. And as you said earlier, it's saved your life, basically.
Yeah, for sure. You know, summer 23 years ago, I was, I'm 14 and a half. I'm a light heavyweight. And back then, I'd gone to 9 stone. I was in big trouble, big trouble. And
didn't anybody see that happening to you and try and intervene? And yeah. Did you accept that? I mean, you're very accepting of it now, but...
No, one of the things in life I will still have to balance is my wife, Helen. At that time, tried to intervene, but, you know, trying to help an addict is a fool's errand, right?
Yeah.
That people trying to help addicts are using those tools that I talked about earlier on. They're using experience, common sense, problem solving. You know, they try and figure out a hypothesis. You know, the people immediately around someone who's really deep into addiction, that's an awful place to be, because they're looking at their dad, their partner, their son, their brother, their best mate. They're trying to do, they try tough talking, they try love, they try different things. All of those things will not work until that person's accepted it and in a place where they're going to do something about it themselves.
Exactly.
And
that's solutions.
That's the cruelest place to be.
Yeah.
So I still look back on and sometimes feel shame about, but sometimes use it as fuel. My experience and my behavior then, when I was just recklessly didn't care, truly didn't care whether I was alive or dead, in a dark, 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 dark place. And, you know, my wife, because she loved me, tried to do something about it, tried all everything that she could to do that. But I wasn't receptive to that.
No, you wouldn't.
And, she did in the end, the smartest thing, which said, if you know, I can't be around you and you can't be around your kids if you're not going to do something about it. And,
was that the trigger?
No, the trigger was when somewhat later on in that dark period, my rock bottom, as they call it, my lowest point in my life was not a incident, but it was a period of time where I was so low, so despondent. And actually what happened was my son, who was 4 years old at the time, had an accident where he fell over the balcony, the banister at home, and fell down, bouncing off a stairwell, multiple floors.
Oh, God.
And broke his thigh, compound fracture on his, you know, the bone was, you could see the bone sticking out, broke his arm, I think he did his arm, his finger, hit his head. He was, you know, a four-year-old in big trouble.
I'm holding my breath here because that's horrendous.
It was awful, and it was my fate, higher power, whatever you want to call it, whatever it is you as an individual believe in. I believe it was my fate saying to me, you holding a mirror up to me saying, right, this is it. You talk a good game, here's where you need to dramatically step up. And I was given that opportunity. And it, you know, there were months in hospital, there were months in the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, and it was almost like the Christmas Carol, you know, the ghost of Christmas past and what have you.
Yeah, Christmas future.
I stayed in that hospital. I was stayed next to his bed, and you know, helped with the kids, teaching every day. It was in a children's ward, so I volunteered, helped out, stayed with him, and I realized, I saw children that passed away without anyone around them. I saw.
Were you still drinking?
No, I stopped. I had actually stopped, I think, the week before. I was doing what they call white knuckling it, where you're using the tools that are not going to work. So I was using willpower. And willpower, this sounds really weird. Willpower, you know, doesn't work when it comes to treating a full-blown addiction.
No, it doesn't
work.
No.
So I was doing that, and they call that white knuckling it. And so, but I've never drunk or used again after that period of time.
It's desperate, though, isn't it, that something like that has to happen?
Yeah.
For you to change your life.
You know, some people have. For me, it took that. It took the brutality of that for me to realise, to come to my senses, and that's a great expression, come to your senses. Yeah. I love the second step of the 12 steps of AA, where they talk about, step one talks about admitting, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. Interesting choice of words, you know, the adjective that they use to describe the worst state that a human can be in, as our lives have become unmanageable. And
well, that's quite interesting, that, though, isn't it? Just that word in itself, because the opposite of that, of course, means manageable.
Yeah, and it starts with we. It doesn't start with I, it starts with we.
Yeah.
So straight away, straight out of the gate, you understand that you can't do this on your own. But the second step talks about we came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That's a cracker, you know, in that it means we came to believe, which is deliberately... has a couple of meanings, right? We came to believe, we physically came to meetings and a process and an environment and a place where we were looking to get better. And we came to believe, which indicates a sort of emotional acceptance, right? So we, over a period of time, we both physically came and we, within ourselves and in terms of acceptance, we
is came there a spiritual to believe, side to believe.
Yeah, we came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And if you accept that, believe that, it's pretty loaded, right? A power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Very loaded.
You are accepting you are insane. And my behavior in you know, 2001, well, my behavior, my addictive behavior all my life was insane. It just doesn't make sense. And love that that definition of insanity. Doing the same thing over and over again, thinking you'll get a different result, is a good definition of insanity.
Yeah.
So I had lost my mind. I was insane. And it took something seismic to change that. However, other people have different levels. Everyone's different. And everyone's definition of, you know, when they're in trouble is different. So, again, I think it's potentially dangerous to look at other people's stories and compare yourself against them with a view that, well, I'm not as bad as that, or that's not me. There's a great saying in 12-step recovery where they talk about look for the similarities, not the differences. And actually, that's something I apply in my creative work and in my job and in my advice. It's something I've taken out of that part of my life and applied in other parts of my life. Look for the similarities, not the differences. So we're all different. We're all, you know, we're different genders, we're different demographics, different social backgrounds, different family backgrounds. But there are consistent traits and themes within mental health, people suffering in mental health, that are consistent. And if you spot those in other people and you see what they've done about it, you can learn from that. And so my story was dramatic. You know, I lost a lot. I didn't end up in prison. I didn't die around me. And by the way, I've heard over the years plenty of stories where that has happened to people.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you as an individual and anyone listening to this will know themselves. There'll be a period where they're keeping it to themselves and they're living in fear and they're struggling. And that's an awful, lonely place to be. And then what usually happens is you get to a point where that has to change. And
well, it could change in a number of ways, can't it? Because it can change. Either you go down the route to recovery, or you actually go down the route to end your life.
Yeah. Well, they talk about the gates of insanity. You know, addiction, if you think about addiction as a third person, in the third person, you know, it's something that wants, will take everything you've got, including your life.
Yeah.
And it'll do it quickly, slowly, but it will take your family, your wealth, your sanity, and eventually your life. So,
but the
gates of insanity and beyond.
Yeah, but it's so powerful, isn't it? I mean, depression is incredibly powerful, as is addiction, and the two are linked, I suspect. But
which is so powerful because it's if you choose to, and not everyone does, but if you think about it as a disease, what characterizes it is it's a disease that, unlike most others, that tells you you don't have it. So you and I talked about hay fever earlier on, right? I know I've got hay fever. It happens to me every spring. You know, I go out, start sneezing, I take a, you know, tablet, a one-a-day tablet, and I remedy it, right? If I've got COVID, I do a COVID test. The COVID test is pretty clear. Those two bars tell you you've got COVID. Mm. The cruelest thing about addiction is that it's an illness and a disease that tells you you don't have it.
It's invisible.
It's worse than that. It tells you, it actively tells you you don't have it. You don't sit and go, the reason for my behaviour, the reason for that, the reason for this is because I'm an addict.
So it's about admitting to yourself and acknowledging yourself.
So going back to those daily tools that I talked to you about, they part of that process is reminding yourself on a regular basis, I have a fatal illness. I have a fatal illness from which I can have a daily reprieve if I choose to take these certain steps.
You still do that?
23
years later?
Every day. And every
good
week.
Good on you.
As I said to you before, don't... I was very struck when I heard Anthony Hopkins talk about don't give me credit for having the gumption to save my own life. You know, this life is precious.
I know, but I know how hard it is to do that. And I think you should give people credit for that.
Well, thank you. And I'll take that. And you know, another thing I find it very difficult to take when your default state is one of less than, one of the things you just don't believe is when people give you credit and give you
praise.
You're not willing to take it.
You know, I remember my performance reviews, right? Yeah. Not at Diageo, actually.
Yeah.
And it'd be 2 hours long, you know, and generally most of it would be okay, right? Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah.
But the one thing that was negative, I would hear that in my head for the next year.
Yeah.
And it still pops into my head even now. And that's 25 years ago, for Christ's sake.
I found it to be, in business, I could be, look, if we have to negotiate something or we're trying to find an agreement on something, I can do that, you know, with my eyes shut, except for when it comes to me. So
I shouldn't laugh at this, but it's resonating so strongly.
If it came to my, you know, me talking about a contract, me asking for what I thought was fair, struggled, struggle with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why it's always good to have an agent or a representative.
Yeah, somebody
or
else in the room.
And does that for you,
yeah.
You know, that can talk about your true wealth, value.
Yeah, I mean, I do event speaking, occasionally,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And I get paid for it occasionally.
Yeah.
But if I have to negotiate my own fee,
I'm thinking,
oh, no, you're all right, okay, yeah. mate, you're yeah. nice, but I'll do it for nothing.
You know, oh, it's for a good cause. I've got an agent that does that.
Have you?
yeah.
You must give me their address.
Yeah.
So, Yasmin's been saying we need to do an intro, but I'm not going to do that because I'm going to do it right at the end and we'll just have to stitch it together if that's all right.
Oh, okay.
No, we're not. No, we're not. No, I'll do it. I'll do it. Can I do it at the end? I'll do it. You know, I want to do it now. Okay, all right, I'll do it now. All right. So, after an hour's conversation, give or take, Simon Morris, welcome to Just Not Good Enough, mental health podcast, radio show, whatever you want to call it. There's a second title to that as well, because I don't know which it's going to be yet. It's called The Unseen Battle.
Mm.
And we've been through a bit about your mental health and how you deal with it and all that sort of stuff. But how then, given all of that, have you been so successful in your career? You know, you've got Amazon behind you, for one thing. You've got Love Film. You've got Novel. You've got so many entrepreneurial roles, but also so many corporate roles. And I'm just thinking, in my experience, an entrepreneur is an entrepreneur and can't take corporate stuff. But you seem to have done both. What is it about you that you think that made that happen?
I think the... Well, just going back to... From the my life in terms of work, I think the bit that nearly killed me is also the bit that speaks to that in me, in my character, in my makeup. So the drive, I often think about life and tools in terms of a double-edged sword. You know, there's an edge to the sword that can cut through any obstacle, and there's the edge to that sword that can cut and kill you. But they're very closely linked. You know, there's a yin and a yang and a you know, inseparable combination of those two things. So for me, I know when I look back on my life, I know from an early age, I had a drive in me, and I had a ambition. Not so much an ambition. I never saw myself as an ambitious in a job, but I knew I was going somewhere.
You wanted to do something.
I was going somewhere, and I was doing something, and I wanted to achieve, and I wanted to. It wasn't necessarily money focused, but I was going somewhere, and. I think that was in me. That is also characterized by more. You know, I do everything more. You know, they often talk about addiction as a disease of more, but I work hard. I work hard. I'm relentless. I'm non-stopping. You know, when I did boxing in my life, you know, you'd have to knock me out to stop me. But I'll generally work as harder than the average bear, longer than the average bear, and with an engine in me that is just driving me forward. And I think that was what got me in trouble. You know, I never had a sense of balance. I never had a sense of stopping.
Everything to excess.
Everything, a lot of things to excess. But it was also channeled in the right direction, part of whatever success I've had along the way in terms of work. And that has, it's interesting, you talked about corporate. I've worked in, been part of startups, helped startups, been in smaller companies, fast growth companies, and then all the way through to...
Possibly, you know, the biggest company in the planet.
$1 trillion market cap company, which, by the way, you know, my 10 years at Amazon were absolutely fantastic. And
well, I've wondered what you're going to say then.
No, fantastic. And I was in an environment with people and leaders, business leaders there that encouraged, were accepting of my skill set and my potential limitations. were very
Why do you say it like that?
Well, I did feel when I was in my 10 years at Amazon that I didn't have to try and compensate or cover up or hide the things that I wasn't good at. They were very clear. I had a boss, somebody called Neil Lindsay, the big boss, the founder, who were really encouraging and clear about, right, this is what we think you're good at. This is what an area that you can add value, and here's how we can remove things from your corporate life, from your work, that might limit that. You know, I'm terrible at maths. People always ask me that. And, you know, I failed my maths O-level 4 times.
It's an achievement.
It's quite a record, you know. Yeah. I was like the big kid with, you know, starting to grow a beard, sitting in the gym doing my O-levels when children, you know, kids 4 years younger were doing their O-level maths early. And that was always a source of shame for me.
Of course, yeah.
But, you know, I can see things in business. There's a great book in business called Legacy, what we can learn from the All Blacks, what we can learn about life and business from the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, manners, principle, humility, the way to behave, but they also talk about commitment. You know, they talk about you don't necessarily have to have the start. You have the hardest working and you have the team orientated, but you also have people that have the gift of pre-visualization. I know that I can see things, and I don't mean in the sense of that film. I see dead people. I mean, I can.
But that's
see
creativity
a
in you.
Yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
Creativity. I can see a problem. I can see a vision, and I can, and then I've got an engine that can work relentlessly towards that. And that's my DNA. That's my stock in trade. And I do think, you know, in recovery, in the years that I've had in recovery, I spent a lot of time in the prison system. 16 years in places like Wormwood Scrubs and Brixton, and that's, you know, I see people there that are addicts or desperate, you know, that were dealt a different set of cards in life, and you know, I find that very humbling. And
just come back to Amazon. Sorry, Amazon. Yeah. Did they know about your addiction?
Yeah, I had been honest about that from Love Film, which. You know, my rock bottom was 2001. Took a while to get myself back to get some sort of semblance of life back together. Rebuild, you know, myself as a husband and a father and my family.
Simon, thank you so much.
My
honestly,
pleasure.
It's been great. I've really, really enjoyed this. I mean, we haven't talked that much about business, but we've talked about mental health. And a lot of the people who come on here do talk about business. But it's been absolutely refreshing. So thank you for being as honest as you have been.
My pleasure.
And good luck to you, sir.
And to you too. God bless.
Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.